Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. It is a moment in which there's a lot of protecting that's needed in various parts of the world. A man who has been covering most of it assiduously, initially wearing the uniform of the United States Army, through whose ranks he rose to the distinguished status of Lieutenant Colonel. He has gone on to doing great things in civil life as well, notably as a California State Assemblyman, and now as the Vice President for Policy at the highly regarded Texas Public Policy Foundation. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Chuck DeVore. You see his writings, you see his visage in all kinds of places. We're always delighted when it's on this particular program. Chuck, welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Great to be with you, Frank.
You've been writing very, I think, thoughtfully and extensively about what has been going on in Ukraine in the run-up to Vladimir Putin's invasion of the country and in the now several months that have followed it. Give us a current sit rep, if you would, Colonel, as to how you think things look at the moment, both for the people of Ukraine, long suffering, hard fighting, and for Putin himself and his larger agenda.
Right. Well, Frank, I think what we're seeing is a continuation of a trend. When the Russians failed to take Kyiv, we're now seeing the Ukrainians conduct counterattacks in the area around Kharkiv, pushing the Russians back to the international border. And we're seeing the Russians do everything they can to break through in the Donbass Basin area to the extreme east of the nation. We're seeing very limited progress with some of these offensive efforts, with the Ukrainians apparently more than able to blunt the attacks and to keep them contained. Now, this is a really important part of the battle because about 70,000 of Ukraine's best trained and best equipped troops are in the area, standing off against the Russian-backed and largely Russian-officered Donbass Basin separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk. And so what the Russians are trying to do is present the Ukrainians with a choice. Either they can stand and fight and risk getting cut off and surrounded and turned into a cauldron, or they can retreat. And what you're seeing right now is the Russians are just not able to develop the sort of forward momentum to really seriously threaten the Ukrainian forces.
This is somewhat stunning, I think it's fair to say, because they have such huge numbers. They have huge inventory of weapons to draw upon, notably aviation assets. That would have presumably, along with ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, hypersonic missiles, been more than enough to defeat a pretty impressive but considerably smaller, less well-resourced, despite what the United States and others have tried to do to shore them up somewhat, the Ukrainians. Particularly in this Donbass area, there had been a lot of talk that there was going to be an encirclement and an annihilation of these pretty formidable Ukrainian forces. But for all those reasons, quantitative and qualitative advantages would assure their destruction. How is it that this has not happened before now, Chuck, and including it, I'd be very interested in your thoughts about what's been going on with the fabled Russian aviation forces.
Right. So, Frank, I think you're seeing a number of factors come into play all at once. First of all, you're seeing at the highest level some of the comparative advantages of a democracy, no matter how messy and corrupt and trying to improve itself, versus a dictatorial kleptocratic regime, as you have in Russia. And so how that trickles down is that people around Putin can't give Putin bad news. He only wants to hear a certain narrative. And furthermore, what we're finding is that his production chains are corrupt. They're not able to produce the equipment in the numbers or the quality that they are supposed to be manufactured in. And they're not able to maintain them. In fact, we're finding out that when the Russians go to withdraw some of these war stocks, that there are serious problems with, for example, engines missing out of tanks, or the electronics packages missing out of tanks, or the optics, which have very costly, rare minerals that are used to produce those optics. And so what we're seeing are the weaknesses of this system that has enriched the oligarchs around Putin, and of course Putin himself, who's rumored to be, in fact, the wealthiest man in the world, even beyond Elon Musk, all from the ill-gotten gains of the sweat of Russian workers. We're seeing the weaknesses of that system versus Ukraine, which again, as imperfect as it is, as are all governments, as are all things of man, the fact is that they had an existential crisis in 2014, and they took that to heart. And they underwent very, very deep and painful reforms insofar as how they fought, how they organized, et cetera. And I think you're seeing those pay off. And so when it comes to the battle, what you're finding now is that as the Russians have pulled out those broken battalion tactical groups out of the Battle of Kyiv and now Kharkiv, what they've done is they've consolidated these units to create new battalion tactical groups, largely composed of the defeated remnants of Russians who retreated north of Kyiv. And so they have a huge morale problem. And insofar as Russian aviation, again, I think you have a problem with maintenance. But then you also have the issue of they've never gained full air superiority, partially due to very good use of tactics by the Ukrainians to switch around their aircraft from airfield to airfield, and also due to the increasing numbers of Western-provided anti-aircraft missile systems that make it very difficult for the Russians to operate in the theater of operations. So all of these things together, and what you're seeing is absolutely remarkable, as you hinted at, which is that you have a nation in Russia that's considerably larger, that on paper has a lot more troops and equipment, that has been fought to a bloody standstill by its much smaller neighbor.
Yeah. And the battle continues. I don't think we want to write the epitaph on Putin's efforts here just yet. And indeed, there's considerable concern that faced with this stalemate, faced with, you know, the inability to grind the Ukrainian society as well as its fighting forces down to the point where there's really no alternative but surrender effectively, or at least suing for terms from Russia, that we're likely to see Putin deciding that he's going to escalate the magnitude of the, you know, destructive power that he unleashes on them. Very quickly, we've got about a minute. Tell me, Chuck DeVore, whether you think that this leads us inexorably to a nuclear use by Putin, presumably a tactical one.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that yet. I think that a weakness would invite the use of nuclear weapons. But right now, why would Putin invite upon himself even more enemies and even more effective counters? He can barely handle Ukraine as it is. So he's going to continue to threaten use of nuclear weapons. But I think so long as NATO and America stands firm and it doesn't overreact to anything, just, you know, continues to keep the pressure on, I don't see any reason why this would be any different than any other Cold War confrontation that we've seen over the last several decades.
Well, interesting. Chuck, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you about, speaking of the Cold War, the prospect now, impending, it seems, of not one but two nations who tried to sit it out during the Cold War, stay neutral because of, among other things, their proximity to the then Soviet Union, Finland and Sweden, seeking to do exactly what Vladimir Putin says he was determined to try to undo with respect to Ukraine, namely its increasing alignment with the West. Will they go into NATO, and what will his response to that be? That and more with Chuck DeVore right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Like a boa constrictor crushing the last vestiges of life from its prey, the Chinese Communist Party has intensified this week its merciless snuffing of freedom in Hong Kong. On Sunday, its hand-picked thug named John Lee won an uncontested race with 99% of the votes cast by 1,500 hand-picked CCP supporters. Almost immediately, a new roundup of prominent freedom fighters began, with the arrest of Cardinal Joseph Zinn and several others suspected of violating Beijing's odious national security law. They could face life imprisonment when, not if, the rigged judicial system finds them guilty as charged. Such mistreatment of Hong Kong's former archbishop validates his courageous criticism of both Communist China's totalitarian regime and the Pope it reportedly paid handsomely to sell out Catholics in China. Let's pray for these and all Xi Jinping's other victims, current and prospective, which includes us. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. A special welcome to Chuck DeVore, Lieutenant Colonel of the United States Army, retired now with the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Chuck, just very quickly, wrapping up the Ukraine saga, because I do want to turn to the other and arguably much worse threat we're facing from Communist China. But before we do, give us a quick take on what is it that is likely to flow from the decisions now taken by the Finns to ask to become formally members of NATO, and a similar decision that seems in the offing in Sweden.
Right. So I think the important thing with the addition of Finland and Sweden to kind of the northern tier of NATO countries is, of course, in Sweden's case, they were always implicitly aligned with the West during the Cold War, even if formally neutral. And what we've seen over the last several years is continued breaches of Swedish space, of specifically their coastal regions, by Russian submarines and probably unmanned submersibles. And so Russia has continued to violate Swedish sovereignty over the years, presumably because they could.
There was a famous moment when one of their submarines ground itself in a prominent place in Sweden, as I recall, and was the source of much merriment.
Right. And of course, in the case of Finland, there's a long history since Finland was part of the old Russian Empire up until the Russian Revolution. And they had their own internal fight between the Reds and the Whites. And eventually the non-communist Finns won the battle for independence. But ever since World War II, they've really had an interesting relationship where they subverted their own connections, or pardon me, their own independence from a foreign policy standpoint. And so what we're seeing now, I think, is a return to full Finnish independence and a realization by Finland that it would be beneficial for them to be part of this larger defensive alliance.
And do you expect Putin will take this, as well as the other affronts to his pride and his power, as he seems to be trying to adjust to certain realities in Ukraine?
Yeah, I don't see where he has a chance or a choice, because what you're likely going to see is bilateral security guarantees between the U.S. and the United Kingdom and Finland and Sweden extended prior to formal NATO membership. So they're going to come under our bilateral security guarantees very soon, and what's going to happen essentially is Putin's going to pay partial payment for his reckless invasion of Ukraine with a virtual doubling of the front that Russia has to contend with NATO powers. So if you look at the current front, if you will, between Putin and the NATO alliance, mostly the Baltic nations, of course, and the Kaliningrad Oblast, what you find with the addition of Finland is it essentially doubles the mileage that the Russians have to contend with.
Chuck, there's so much more to talk about on that. I did want to hit two other topics with you quickly in about 6 minutes that we have left with you. Let me ask you first, there are those who argue this really isn't our business, this Ukraine conflict and the efforts to reverse what has been done there. Our real preoccupation has to be China. I know you're very seized, as am I, with the threat from China. Do you agree with that, or do you see this as really something that has to be done in addition to direct containment of China, if not reversal of the threats that we're facing there?
I do agree that the threat from China is, by its very nature, more of an existential threat to the United States, given their economy, given the size of their military, given the technological capabilities and the trade. They are a rising power. Russia is a declining power. That said, there are no national security interests of the United States that would be served by a Russian victory in Ukraine. And furthermore, I believe that Russian victory in Ukraine would encourage China and show them that despite the Western alliance standing up and trying to help Ukraine, and despite the economic sanctions, that the old decrepit power of Russia won anyway, which would send exactly the sort of message to the People's Republic of China that perhaps an invasion of Taiwan would in fact be successful. So I see these this current conflict and a potential conflict is very much connected, especially given the very close relationship that we now see between Russia and China.
Indeed. And that, I guess, to take away from that insight, your recommendation would be we must deal with both of these contingencies. And to the extent that we are watching a considerable depletion of our own stocks of equipment, some of it, in fact, actually being sent on of equipment purchased by Taiwan, no less, from us to help the Ukrainians. This is an appropriate use of such limited resources. Obviously, we need to restock our own capabilities, but how do you see that, you know, in the most practical terms at the moment?
Well, I mean, at the very core, the current conflict and a potential conflict at least would be extremely different insofar as the sort of forces that would be used. So we despite the agreements that we made with Ukraine for them giving up their nuclear weapons, our security arrangements with Ukraine aren't even close to the sort of security arrangements and guarantees we have with the democracy on the island of Taiwan. And so as a result, were China to invade, very, very likely you'd see the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy engaged almost immediately along with our Japanese allies. And the sort of equipment and consumables that would be used in that sort of an engagement are completely different than what's being sent over to Ukraine. What you're talking about, of course, are the infantry-based weapons, for example, your shoulder-fired surface-to-air weapons and your anti-tank weapons. And yes, those things need to be produced. Frank, when we served together in the Pentagon, I remember being part of a mobilization exercise where we had a long lead expectation of a then Soviet invasion into the Middle East. And we had to convince Congress to surge the production of long lead items of consumables that would be used in high volumes in conflict, things like Sidewinder missiles and TOW anti-tank missiles. And these are things that are used in vast quantities, and they're complex, and they take a while to make, and especially with today's broken supply chains. So absolutely, we need to be focused on that. We need to bolster our defense industrial base, and we need to make sure that we can produce the sort of armaments that are required in modern combat and produce them here in America.
A war footing is my shorthand call for it, and it seems to me long overdue, and I appreciate your clarity on the need to do that, not only for our friends and allies in both of these theaters, but of course for our own security as well. Chuck, we have about a minute left. Very quickly, as a student of what the Chinese are up to and their expenditures of immense amounts of money that seem in no small measure to be coming from American investors, what do you think of this idea of having American government employees, federal employees, military and civilian, having their retirement funds sent by the likes of Larry Fink of BlackRock and the Thrift Savings Plan to China?
It's a terrible idea, and it's a terrible idea for a number of reasons. First of all, of course, the political risk that there really is no such thing as contract in China. It's all at the whim of the Chinese Communist Party. So those investments could be worth zero within 24 hours. That's number one. Number two, the spectacular hypocrisy of these individuals that are pushing so-called ESG investing for environmental, social, and governance, none of which exist in China. None. It's not a transparent market. It's a very dirty country from the standpoint of pollution and corruption. And it's financing a nation that wants to that sees us as an enemy. Right. So stop it. It's a silly idea.
Especially the likelihood that some of that money is going to go into the building of the weapons that China would use to kill your comrades in arms, Chuck DeVore. Thanks for your clarity on all these issues, my friend, and joining us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. We'll talk morale with Elaine Donnelly, our own morale of military personnel, right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, as is a dear friend and valued colleague of many years. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. She is the founder and president of an indispensable organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has served on both Defense Department and presidential commissions with a focus on assuring not only the readiness and fighting trim of our military, but something a bit more intangible. She calls it the military culture, and very few civilians understand it, let alone have done as much as she has over the years in trying to promote it. And it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with her when she has especially some breaking news, some of it actually positive. Elaine Donnelly, welcome back to Securing America. It's good to have you with us. I wanted to start by just saying that this issue of the morale factor in these, you know, military readiness issues is not only on display in places like Ukraine, as we talked about with our previous guest, Chuck DeVore, it's happening here too. Give us a reading on what has been sort of cumulatively done to the military, particularly during the Biden years, with respect to, you know, their political indoctrination, their purging for not being adequately aligned with, you know, a certain presidential sort of policy preference, and for that matter, you know, vaccine passports and mandates and the like. I mean, these are all bearing, are they not, on the underlying social engineering that's been taking place that you've done so much to both resist and warn about?
Well, I have a combination of bad news and good news. And we already talked about the bad news recently. It has to do with the Army and their change in standards in a basic combat fitness test. The good news is that a United States Senator, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, took on the first female Secretary of the Army and did such an effective job in taking her to task for what the Army has done. I'm absolutely amazed. I've never seen this kind of pushback. We have seen incremental changes in our military going back to, especially from the Bill Clinton years and certainly in the Obama years. And now under Obama, when Obama said, or whether Biden said, diversity is going to be the priority, diversity, equity, and inclusion. These kinds of mandates have had effect. And in the Army, what has happened, and it does affect morale, they have said that, well, we're going to accommodate great numbers of women, even if it means that we have to lower standards. They said, they promised, that they were going to have gender-neutral standards, the same for men and women. Once women got into the combat arms, the infantry, special operations forces, and the like, they promised that over and over and over again. And the Secretary of the Army, as recently as last year, said that. Well, Senator Tom Cotton said to the Secretary of the Army, Christine
Warren, a former Army officer himself, a combat veteran.
That is correct. And he knows what the Army should be doing. And he said, you said you were going to have gender-neutral standards. You just announced you're going to have different standards for men and women. He said he was absolutely disappointed, borderline outraged by this. And I was encouraged to see that. And then he proceeded to go through. He did not let her get away with anything. She said, well, the test is tougher. And he said, no, it's not. He said, this is outrageous. It's going to get people killed. And then he proceeded to go point by point. The reason the Army changed...
Before you do that, though, Elaine, let me just level set here. When you talk about standards, this is not some abstraction. This is very specifically tied to the ability of men and women in the combat arms now to perform their functions. And this is why Senator Cotton's talking about people getting killed if they can't perform their functions because they're simply not ready. People will die.
To go into the infantry, you only have to do 10 push-ups. Now, maybe a woman can be trained to do 10 push-ups, but an infantry leader certainly needs to be much stronger than that. And then he picked up on something that I noticed also when we did the analysis of this about a month ago. It says that the commander cannot raise the standards to make them commensurate with the demands of tougher, more physically demanding jobs. So that's when he said, this is going to get people killed. If you say that an infantry person doesn't have to meet the same high standards that he did, he said, what do you mean, 10 standards? I had to do 35, just for starters. The more he went into it and the level of excellence is being sacrificed for, well, diversity metrics, mediocrity instead of meritocracy, he saw this trend and he confronted her. And she squirmed. I think she was totally surprised when this colloquy started. And he did not let her get away with anything. And I was very encouraged by the way he brought out the fact that the Army needs to return to standards that match the MOS, the military occupational specialty. They cannot be gender normed. There is no gender norming on the battlefield. They must be gender neutral the way they promised they would be. Now, I always knew those promises would never hold up. But
because what that would mean in practice is women would have to perform at a level that physiologically they may simply be incapable of achieving.
But we've known this all along. The Army did a study, but they didn't believe the Marine Corps. So RAND did a study. That's a liberal contractor for Department of Defense. And they found that only 50% of the women could pass this gender neutral test compared to 90 plus on the part of the men. They put it in actual data. And that's when the Army decided, well, I guess we're going to have to return to gender normed standards, different from men and women, and forget
meaning, about meaning reality. That women who are not sufficiently strong or otherwise fit to meet the test that the battlefield demands, not arbitrary, but actual hard experience teaches they must perform at, they're going to meet lower standards and they will be unable as a result in all likelihood to perform as they may need to in life and death situations. So Elaine, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about. What is the way forward here? Is it basically that we should not have women in the combat arms, the infantry of the United States armed forces, whether it's the Army or the Marine Corps?
There are several suggestions that we made in the policy analysis last month, and Senator Cotton did the first one. He confronted the policymakers. It's not about women, it's the policymakers. The Army has consciously decided that they will accept in the infantry and the combat arms soldiers that they know cannot perform at the level that is commensurate with the job. They are doing that for reasons of diversity. So the second thing you have to do is get all the diversity mandates.
Get rid of those diversity mandates. And that means effectively then only putting into the combat arms, if any would, you know, pass muster, as they say, women who have, you know, extraordinary physical strength to perform at that level that's required.
That's right. In fact, he even quoted the first female infantry officer, the one who first wanted to get through Ranger training, and she said that any kind of double standard is unacceptable. And it was very clever of him, I think, Senator Cotton and Wise, to quote this female soldier. Now, the implication here is you cannot have high standards and gender diversity quotas of 25-30% women. In order to do that, you have to lower the standards. In fact, we've already seen Special Operations Command do this in the Air Force. There's a female combat controller candidate. She has failed, dropped out several times. They keep bringing her back. This is demoralizing to everyone who is aware of the way diversity is taking precedence over meritocracy. Now, everything starts with a first step. Senator Cotton has taken a first step. And that's why I think we need to applaud that and encourage others to do the same.
Talk a little bit about some of the other steps that you've outlined in your policy recommendations. And again, people can find all of that at cmrlink.org, including the videotape of Senator Cotton cross-examining the Army Secretary. But what else should be done now to, again, not only preserve the, you know, morale of the military, but its ability to perform the function that is absolutely vital to our security, namely defending us?
One thing that the Congress could do is stop hearing from Pentagon policymakers who have an interest in promoting their own work. They need to go out in the field, and they need to bring in independent witnesses. And you don't have to be a former infantry officer like Senator Cotton in order to see through false information when you see it. And in order to see the numbers are there, even RAND, a liberal outfit, had to report that this is the fact. Women cannot compete with men in the physical aspects of the combat arms. I'm not talking about courage. I'm not talking about commitment to serve. We need women.
Or other skills, perhaps. But this takes a certain skill set that is a function of physiology.
Right. We need to match the person to the job. And if that means that there are no gender quotas, this would be a better way to go. And it will take some leadership, perhaps a new president, that would give the orders to the Pentagon, and people in the Pentagon have to follow orders. And if their new orders say, you will make sure that we have the best merit must be the primary thing in the Army, not gender diversity quotas. There's a whole raft of...
In the Army and all of the services. So, Landon, we have to leave it at this, but the key point, and you do such a superb job of this at the Center for Military Readiness, my friend, is to actually be honest about the fact that, as Donald Rumsfeld famously said, you go to war with the Army you have, and Army and Air Force and Navy and Marine Corps and so on. But if we go to war before there's a new president, and that Army turns out to have been hollowed out, whether it's as a result of these gender policies, quotas, and the rest, or perhaps some of the other things that I alluded to earlier, we will suffer perhaps not only ignominious defeat, but perhaps nation-threatening defeat. Elaine Donnelly, thank you so much. Keep up the great work. George Raceley is up next on a whole host of issues, including election integrity, right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Like a boa constrictor crushing the last vestiges of life from its prey, the Chinese Communist Party has intensified this week its merciless snuffing of freedom in Hong Kong. on Sunday. Its hand-picked thug named John Lee won an uncontested race with 99% of the votes cast by 1,500 hand-picked CCP supporters. Almost immediately, a new roundup of prominent freedom fighters began, with the arrest of Cardinal Joseph Zinn and several others suspected of violating Beijing's odious national security law. They could face life imprisonment when, not if, the rigged judicial system finds them guilty as charged. Such mistreatment of Hong Kong's former archbishop validates his courageous criticism of both Communist China's totalitarian regime and the Pope it reportedly paid handsomely to sell out Catholics in China. Let's pray for these and all Xi Jinping's other victims, current and prospective, which includes us. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say that one of the smartest guys I know is in the house, virtually, a man who we consult with on all hosts, a whole host of issues, all manner of issues, is what I'm trying to say, because his personal expertise over decades in political life and public policy more generally gives him standing to comment on just about everything that we work on here at Securing America. His name is George Raceley. He is, no kidding, a genius, a certified member of Mensa, as well as an extremely accomplished political practitioner with some 300 campaigns to his credit at all levels of our government. And I am always learned from him, and I'm delighted to help the rest of you do so now. And George, welcome back to Securing America. Good to have you, sir.
Thank you, Frank. I'm sure I could be certified someplace by someone.
I'm doing the certification for the moment with the help of Mensa. Here's the question that I want to start with. I talked a little bit about it with one of our previous guests, Chuck DeVore, retired military officer. You are a retired civilian government employee. And our audience has been hearing about this in kind of the abstract for some time, that we've got this incredible problem that our financial sector, personified by one of the most important figures in it, a fellow by the name of Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, is determined to put investment savings in general of the American investor community, and now specifically the investment and retirement savings of people like yourself, George, a member, a participant of the so-called Thrift Savings Plan, into companies owned and controlled by our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. As a man with skin in the game, as they say, what do you make of this? And what should the rest of us be thinking, and more to the point, doing to try to prevent it from coming about, if you agree?
Well, you know, we went through this same argument a year or two ago, and Trump managed to do the right thing and shut it down when they were talking about investing military pensions in Red China.
Military and civilian, to be honest. I mean, it was the same question. It was just different techniques for doing it.
And so, of course, as someone who still has some dough in the TSP from my government service, I'm adamantly opposed to this. I think everyone should be adamantly opposed to this. I mean, the equivalent of giving our mortal enemy, as you refer to them, Red China, the money to buy the weapons and to engage in the intelligence operations to defeat us. And, you know, we might as well just send a boatload of Abrams tanks over to them as allow them to invest or rather force former and current government employees to invest in Red China. And all of these...
Well, The defenders of this idea and the way they're doing it now is they're opening what they call a mutual fund window, in which they will have on offer 5,000 mutual funds, and people like you can pick one or more to invest up to 25% of your savings with the Thrift Savings Plan in them. So they'll describe it as a voluntary thing. The problem is, George, that they have made it clear, the people who run this operation, that they're not going to tell you which of these mutual funds have Chinese companies in portfolio. So, you know, it's Russian roulette, I guess, or worse, you will wind up with lots of them in your own personal portfolio that have these Chinese companies. Worse than the Abrams tanks, I would argue, we're sending them thermonuclear devices, because this is funding not just, as you say, military weapons acquisitions or even intelligence operations. It's everything that the Chinese are up to globally, from the Belt and Road Initiative to their economic warfare against us to their subversion and elite capture and on and on. Thanks in part to the American investors' underwriting. So I appreciate so much your clarity on this, George, and think it's really vital that, as you say, not only people who are participants in the program, but all of us get up and righteously indignant about this and shut it down. George, let me turn to another thing quickly before we have to take a short break. There is an effort being made to subvert our sovereignty with the World Health Organization. You know a lot about these international organizations and who's largely calling the shots in them, namely, again, the Chinese Communist Party. Is it advisable to have a guy like Dr. Tedros of the World Health Organization telling us what's a public health emergency and what we'll do about it?
Absolutely not. I mean, we saw how this guy operated at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, where he couldn't even use the word China in relationship to the origins and the ongoing, spread of it. He's where he is because of Red China's votes. They pull his strings. And so to the extent that this guy can be, in essence, mobilized as a Red Chinese asset against us, they're going to use him as they use every other lever of power that they can get their hands on.
And George, one of the things that, as you know, they've done actually quite successfully, in part with his help, but part, to be fair, that of Anthony Fauci and others in our own government, who, oh, by the way, that's right, we're funding gain of research, gain of function research in China, that brought us, I believe, this disease. But you have this China model that the Chinese have had on display of late in Shanghai, notably, and other places, the lockdowns, the mandates, the forced separation, the forced vaccinations, the vaccine passports, the whole social credit system. And we're going to have to take a quick pause. I would pick this up on the other side of a short break. But to the extent that Dr. Tedros has been an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party in helping foist this so-called model, we call it a digital gulag, on the rest of us, it is outrageous. And I just want to talk with you a little bit about the implications if we allow this to happen again, notably, perhaps, for our election integrity, another matter on which you're deeply knowledgeable. We'll talk about all of that and more with George Raceley on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with our resident expert and genius, George Raceley. He is talking to us a little bit about a travesty that is underway. If the Biden administration can pull it off, it will have engaged in the largest surrender of our sovereignty, I believe, in our nation's history. Voluntary sovereignty, surrender, that is. So, George, you've studied, I think, the cumulative effects on our society, on our people, on our children, on our freedoms, as a result of the kinds of things Dr. Tedros, no medical doctor, by the way, prescribed to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic 2 years or so ago, pretty much as directed to do so by his masters in Beijing. Give us a flavor of what that would mean if he were in fact able now to tell us what is a public health emergency of international concern, entirely on his own, and then what we must do about it, which is the plan for the Team Biden amendments.
Yeah. Well, what it would enable the WHO to do is tell us, for example, oh, too dangerous to have in-person elections. We're going to have to go to universal mail-in ballots. Oh, too dangerous to open up your consumer economy to have people dining in person in restaurants and going to stores. Got to shut down things like they are in Shanghai, where they literally have built cages around apartment blocks so that people cannot get out.
And they welded shut their gates,
yeah,
in some instances.
And they welded them shut. They have people, in essence, a police force out in moon suits to arrest anyone, and they arrest them with great prejudice, I might add, who ventures out outside these lockdowns. So you're putting this guy who's a red Chinese puppet in charge of not just our economy, but our elections, our own personal freedoms. You're literally giving one guy the power, a guy, I might add, who is no friend of the United States, the power to once again destroy our economy.
What's left of it. George, and here's the kicker. I mean, again, if it would be bad enough if it were one guy who is, you know, a puppet, as you say, of communist China. But as a practical matter, that means it's communist China that would be dictating what is going to be done here, as they did earlier with this this China model. So let me come again to your area of particular expertise, my friend. We've seen this movie before, I guess is the hackneyed phrase, but we're now seeing not one but two very important documentaries rigged by David Bossi and his team at Citizens United, and Dinesh D'Souza's new film with Catherine Engelbrecht of True the Vote, entitled 2,000 Mules. Both of these lay out an extraordinarily compelling case that the kinds of techniques that you talked about a moment ago, those mail-in ballots, those machines that have to be used, those drop boxes that Mark Zuckerberg put all about, and the like, so that we didn't have, you know, people endangered by their voting practices, all conduced to fraud, material, consequential, indeed devastating fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Do you agree with that basic proposition? And more to the point, if we were to revert to it, are we likely to see a similar kind of outcome in 2022 and obviously 2024 if it happens?
Absolutely. And I agree 100% with it, Frank. 2,000 Mules is a very, very compelling movie. The thing that I found most compelling about it was that it has real science behind tracking all these ballot harvesters, dropping off votes in the ballots in the middle of the night, making sure their fingerprints were not on the ballots by wearing surgical gloves.
After somebody got nailed for having fingerprints on, you know, ballot stuffing.
And
not an accident, comrade.
No, indeed. And so, you know, the whole point of this is it's the old Stalin comment about not who votes, it's who counts the votes. This is guaranteed to have the same result as 2020. There will be key swing states where the result will not be known, and it certainly won't be credible because of these ballot harvesting, vote box stuffing, whatever you want to call it.
Fraud, I think, felony offenses against our, you know, election laws. That's what I would call it. And you're absolutely right. Hey, George, we're almost out of time. I did want to ask you about one other thing quickly. A dear mutual friend of both of ours, Ginny Thomas, married to Justice Clarence Thomas, is among the spouses and family members and members of the Supreme Court who are now being directly threatened, seemingly with the, acquiescence, to put it charitably, of the Biden administration to mobs of people ostensibly upset about abortion, but seemingly having other agendas in mind. In 40 seconds, tell us what's going on here. What are the risks for our country if it's not checked?
Well, what's going on is exactly what went on when Democrats employed their previous version of their armed direct action wing, the Ku Klux Klan. And all of these laws that were passed prohibiting intimidating federal judges and other federal officials were passed to fight the Klan, which of course was the armed wing of the Democrat Party. Now here we are back again. The armed wing of the Democrat Party is pulling the same things, and Biden is not only not enforcing the law, you've got the press secretary up there encouraging people to do this from the White House podium.
Yes, this is outrageous. It must stop. I want you back next week, George, to talk about what we do about it. I want the rest of you back tomorrow here at Securing America. Thank you for joining us for today. And I hope when you are able to, you will be back with us for more. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.